Like, if you're going to listen because you're just like, oh, okay, well, if I buy a 2-cent syringe, it's not going to cost the $450,000 to treat one uninsured person in America with HIV. And those are old numbers I'm using. So, like, with inflation this year, probably talking like $700,000 for one person.
One Quick Thing brings you easy, actionable ways to support your local community in times where we need it most. If you're feeling overwhelmed and don't know where to start, join us on this journey as we make meaningful connections with local businesses, organizations, and neighbors. We're hosting a free live podcast recording and community event at Auspicious Brew in Dover on Tuesday, July 29th. Check the event registration link below to join us. Today we're joined by Liz from New Hampshire Harm Reduction Coalition. We discuss the range of support that harm reduction provides, as well as ways we can all help demystify these often misunderstood services.
Like, it's so, because it's, I mean, the drug supply in America is apocalyptic, period. Like, the unregulated supply is apocalyptic. But I think that there are a lot of really powerful groups that are doing drug checking programs that give us just kind of like a whisper of an idea of what's in our supply. Because, like, you know, we have supervised consumption streets on every single main street. Like, people go to bars all the time. They're able to get their supply safely regulated, tested. Mm-hmm. Like, if something bad happens, they can get retribution for it. But, like, people who use drugs that they buy on the street, they don't. So it's like two different worlds.
Yeah. I feel like it makes it so clear when you put it in those terms. Like, I hope that genuinely resonates with anybody who's having a hard time understanding what you do.
Yeah, I think... my dad always called it word jujitsu, where you just have to, like, speak in somebody else's language. And you, like, you know, as loud as a radical leftist as I am, it's not going to work when I'm talking to cops. It's not going to work when I'm trying to defeat fentanyl misinformation. Like, that stuff just doesn't work. So you have to, like, let them get out all the stigma and then be like, okay, but I know you're smarter than this. Like, I know you know better than this. And it's like, if you get down to the core of it, I think especially with, like, law enforcement, which is really hard because, you know, it's a broken system. Mm-hmm. But there are individuals throughout the system that maybe don't like it as broken as it is. And if you can, like, appeal to them, and if it means, like, I find one guy who's not going to break up a camp or not going to, like, beat the crap out of a participant, then, like, that's a huge win. And then he gets to, like, start the wave and spread it. So, like, all those things, I don't care what you're coming from, is just, like, if you're going to listen because you're just like, oh, okay, well, if I buy a 2-cent syringe, it's not going to cost the $450,000 to treat one uninsured person in America with HIV. And those are old numbers I'm using. So, like, with inflation this year, probably talking, like, $700,000 for one person.
Could you tell us a little bit about what New Hampshire Harm Reduction Coalition does?
Yeah. So we are the statewide coalition who either operates the SSPs in the state. So we have direct service SSPs, and we always will have.
What's an SSP?
Yeah, what's an SSP?
A syringe service program. Okay. So a syringe service program is, some people call it a needle exchange or syringe exchange. But that's when you are coming to me, you're getting clean needles, I'm giving you the clean needles, you're giving me your dirty ones, and then you're also getting, like, safe injection supplies or safer smoking supplies or safer snorting or boofing or, like, anything you need mm-hmm. to be able to use your drugs safely and cleanly. And then, like, overdose prevention supplies, wound care, basic connection to any medical or social service you could possibly need, because our care coordinators in each region are so ingrained in that area. Like, we have our Concord Exchange is hosted in it's a mobile exchange out of our big beautiful van, it's at a methadone clinic in Concord, and then it hides out, like, in a little bridge kind of area where, like, folks usually camp and walk through to, like, the kitchen to get lunch and stuff. So it's a good place to capture folks. And then we have Manchester, our Queen City Exchange, which is gigantic, and they operate in 2 days. They see, like, 150 people on each day just out of the back of the van. So It's like a needed service, but they have connections to Manchester Mental Health and Waypoint and everything in between. And Manchester Public Health Department hangs out with us there. So they do testing on Tuesdays for HIV and Hep C. And I think they also do like some other blood tests as well. Like they do like the kind of full panel blood test for folks, which is cool. Because there's not a lot of options for folks to just like drop in and get a test. And then we have our Seacoast Exchange, which is Somersworth, Rochester, Dover. And those happen throughout the week. And
can you talk a little bit about what the, for those of us who aren't familiar with the idea of a syringe exchange or aren't familiar with the idea of harm reduction in general, can we take a step even further back and talk about like why those tactics are so important for somebody who maybe is like, why are you giving them supplies? Like, what's the answer to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we have to start with like the zoomed in piece first, because then you get the like stigma out of it where it's just like, wait, you're giving them needles. Wouldn't that just enable them? Which is my least favorite word ever. But it is enabling them because it's enabling folks to participate in their own health and wellness. So essentially all that means is that like harm reduction is, we do it every day. Like I'm wearing sunscreen right now. I wore my seatbelt when I drove over here. My kid has to wear a helmet when he rides his bike. Like those are harm reduction tools because we do things in our lives every day that have innate risk. But we have mitigation tools that reduce those risks. So when we're talking about drugs specifically, these are the tools that we can put in place that are tangible things for people who use drugs to mitigate those risks associated with using illicit drugs. And I think that like harm reduction in like the recovery world is kind of like the dirty word a lot of the times, unfortunately. We're kind of like the stepchild. And so like I think that folks think that harm reduction has to have a specific definition of just like, oh, well, you can use needles now, but then you'll never use anything ever again. You'll stop using drugs forever. But that's not realistic for every human being. And I think that harm reduction has a whole health approach to people who use drugs, but it also zooms it way into that individual where it's just like my body chemistry is different than your body chemistry, and when you interact illicit substances into that, creating something completely different. You know, I could use meth, somebody else could use meth, we could have two entirely different reactions to it. I could use it once and be like, not for me. Someone could use it once and develop a substance use disorder. And so like harm reduction for me is like defining that there's substance use, because people can use substances and not use them chaotically or have extreme risks or harm themselves and their family. And then people can have substance use disorder. And those are two big things. One of them you get diagnosed with. One of them you just do.
Yeah.
One of them all of us do. Like, you drink coffee, you take your Adderall, you, all those things. So harm reduction in general is giving, like, people who use drugs autonomy. It's giving them their power back. It's giving them the ability to think and feel for themselves and make their own decisions, because when we really think about it, and especially somebody from, like, I came from working in a treatment field. I was, like, the person who was like, I'm going to invent the drug that makes no one take a drug ever again. And realizing that's a ridiculous myth. Coming out of that and realizing that, like, it actually doesn't matter if the end goal is is abstinence. That doesn't really matter. The end goal doesn't matter as long as, like, the end goal is, like, you're safer, you're feeling loved, you're feeling connected to your community, you're feeling connected to the people who use drugs around you, because that's a really safe network for folks. So harm reduction is a ton of things, and I think that it's not just needles. It's, like, building community and autonomy for every individual in that.
That was such an excellent explanation. And it was really beautiful, too. And one thing that we were talking about earlier is that folks that have never experienced substance abuse or addiction are lucky. Like, that it's not about, like, you know, I am you know, good and the people that are adding morality to it. It is genuinely about numbers and luck and, like, you know, the life that you were born into, like anything else, you know what I mean? Or the body you were born into. And I think that anybody who is speaking against harm reduction and the incredible work that you do is either so privileged that they don't, or nobody they love has experienced that, which is wild statistically. Like, what vacuum are they in?
And I think that, like, some of the harm reduction haters actually come from those individuals who have usually a loved one who has been in chaotic use and they're hurt by, like, and I think a lot of that hate comes from hurt. Like, you know, anger is a secondary emotion. And, like, the number one emotion is just, like, I miss that person. Yeah. Like, I'm sad for that person. And I've definitely done it myself to loved ones where it was just, like, cut it off right away. This is what school taught me when I was getting my BA. Like, this is what everyone tells you who's a LADAC is just, like, cut them off. But that doesn't solve anything. Yeah. And to me, it's like, I'd rather, you know, there are definitely boundaries you have to set for some folks where, like, maybe safety's at risk. Maybe, like, you know, kiddos are at risk. Those things are different and they take, like, specific resources and understanding. But for the majority of it, it's like, I would rather have somebody steal from me a million more times if it meant that I didn't have to lose them.
Yeah.
And I think folks forget that point, that it's just like, that's just not them in a lot of ways, is, you know, their brain's on fire with chemical reactions. And, you know, it sucks to watch people respond to something scientific with so much vitriol and just, like, kind of, you know, hatred of that person and that individual. And, you know, we get, like, tons of hate comments on social media about just, you're enabling everybody and you just want expletive about someone who uses drugs or whatever to run the streets, and, like, all these homeless people are leaving needles everywhere. And it's like, I don't know. Have you ever tried to live outside? Like, have you ever tried to live outside while also being dependent on opioids? Because when you're sick, especially on opioids, the only thing you want to think about is not getting sick. It's like, withdrawal from opioids is, like, the worst flu you can possibly imagine times 10 for just some folks. So, you know, I think the harm reduction haters kind of also come from a good place of just, like, someone needs to let them open up their hate a little bit, get it all out, and then, like, get down to the center and be like, okay, but this is because you miss that person. This is because, like, you've been hurt by that person. And yeah.
The compassion with which you approach folks who are negatively impacting folks who need, you know, the extra support is, it just shows so much about your character.
Oh, thank you. I mean, don't get me wrong, I am really grumpy about it 90% of the time, and I have some colorful stuff to say to politicians involved in it, because while they've probably been hurt, it all comes down to money and power for politicians.
Should we talk about the policies a little bit? Should we? That's a nice little transition. Yeah. Should we jump ahead?
Yeah. Take that off ramp.
Every policy about people who use drugs impacts them because they are a law-involved group that is always stigmatized. You know, sometimes you get a phenomenal, like, drug court representative who, like, gets it, and you get lucky. But a lot of the times, like, you're getting shoved into jail without any kind of, like, medication-assisted treatment. And then you're detoxing in jail, and a lot of the time, you could die. Like, people think that, like, oh, well, you're using opioids, you can just detox that cold turkey. And it's just like, if I have a heart condition and I have just stopped taking opioids, I could easily die. And I, regardless of that, I just don't think it's humane to let people, like, urinate and defecate all over themselves in the middle of detention centers because they decided to use drugs for pain, because that's where a lot of it comes from, is, like, I started using drugs for chronic pain. I started using drugs for chronic pain, and it wasn't until I realized that I developed healthcare systems that I was privileged enough to tap into that actually cared about me and took care of me that I was able to like stop using that. And then you have to like work on your brain and then that's a whole other journey. So, right. But I think the biggest policies that could impact people who use drugs positively right now are there's always bills going up about drug checking in New Hampshire. And so in the state of New Hampshire, well, first off, drug checking is, you know, not peeing in a cup to see if you're dirty or whatever. Right. Drug checking is I'm getting my drug I'm going to use. I am checking it for the presence of things that I don't necessarily want to put into my body. So I have a better idea of what I am putting into my body. Mm-hmm. In New Hampshire, we don't have any drug checking laws. Vermont, Maine, Massachusetts, they have awesome drug checking programs. So like what I do as a big drug composition nerd is kind of just make anecdotal maybes about what's going on.
Can I pause you for a second? For what does that mean? What is involved in a drug checking program? Like, is that somebody like, what does that look like logistically?
Yeah. So it can look different for every single program, but mostly it's somebody who understands how to run an FTRI machine, which please don't make me say the whole thing out.
We'll Google it later.
Or like a mass spectrometer, the stuff you'd see on like forensic CSI kind of stuff where you are taking a baggie of illicit substance or a vial or whatever you want to test. You're running it through this machinery and it's telling you it's like an FTRI runs within like 5%. So if there's like within that range in the supply you've got, then it'll tell you there's this much fentanyl, there's this much metatomidine, there's this much xylazine, there's this much lactic acid, there's this much baby powder. It'll tell you all the compositions of the actual drug that you got. Wow. And that's like the high-tech stuff. So in New Hampshire, we have little test strips that tell us yes or no. So it's like and it's literally the opposite of a pregnancy test. So you like get it and you're just like, oh, one line means I have fentanyl in my whatever. Mm. But like the reason why we started using them is because it's super helpful for like folks that are using stimulants like crack, cocaine, methamphetamines, Prespill, Adderall, stuff like that, to know if you're getting fentanyl in it. Because if you're getting fentanyl in it and you are a novice fentanyl person, then you could have a high risk of overdose. Mm-hmm. But you know, our dope supply in New Hampshire is full of fentanyl, so like you wouldn't use it on that. But now our dope supply is changing and we have horse tranquilizer like xylazine and other tranquilizer like metatomidine. And we don't have 100% proof, so I can kind of say maybe based off of the symptoms that you're having, based off of like how folks are reporting their drugs changing, the wounds they're getting, because with xylazine, you can get really severe wounds that are horrific to heal, especially during the summer. Ugh. Wounds get so bad during the summer because you just don't have, you're always sweaty, you're always icky.
Yeah.
And so you could have crack in your fentanyl, like you could have anything in it, and that'll affect your tolerance to it, especially if you're like, I have a baggie and this week the person who I'm buying from decided to put like two scoops of fentanyl instead of one, so now I have something really, really strong, then my body gets used to that, and then next week it's one scoop, my body is in pain because my tolerance has changed.
Wow.
And so New Hampshire, so we're not, it sounds like we're not as sort of advanced on that front. Is that kind of what your primary struggle looks like when you're dealing with these politicians?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that they disagree with on the drug checking bill, because what we want is we want to be able to like bring in the professionals, have the FTRI machines, the mass spectrometry, and have New Hampshire's drug supply analyzed by an unbiased service, because like you can do post-mortem testing, but like the metabolite, like the way your body metabolizes drugs changes after you die, or even just like peeing. Right now they're doing wastewater testing, which like, again, that's like, it's all different. It's not showing you what's in the actual supply because the supply is not in front of you. You're doing secondaries. But the biggest thing that politicians seem to keep running into is how much of a drug is legal so that we can test it.
Yeah.
Which to me is just so silly. Yeah. Like, you know, I understand the fear that drug dealers will find loopholes and blah, 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 blah. But, like, I don't think that politicians understand that, like, the people I'm going to get that are going to come to exchange and test their drugs are going to be people selling drugs because they don't want their friends to die. They don't, like, you get into selling drugs because of a socioeconomic stance, because you do not have enough to supply your family with, because you want to take care of your friends, because you use yourself. There's tons of reasons, and it doesn't make them the boogeyman. Like, we've all been told that they are. And I have so many people who sell that come to exchange and say, I don't let anybody leave without Narcan. I don't let anybody leave without clean needles. They'll give us, like, $50 to $100 every time because they are part of the community, too. They're not trying to hurt their community members. And not to mention, it's just bad business practice. Yeah. If you kill off all your customers, then what do you do for business?
Right.
But that seems to be the biggest issue that law enforcement runs up into is, well, if we legalize this amount, then that means they can just push it through the border and kind of some, you know, made up misinformation kind of stuff. But like if you're using fentanyl test strip, it takes literally, if you're looking at a penny, the hair on Lincoln's head, that's about how much you need to test off of a test strip. Sometimes you need even less to be able to test on a FTRI machine. So it's such a minimal amount.
Yeah.
But we want to get a full picture. So we've made the amounts like larger. I don't even remember what we changed it to in the most recent bill because they have gone back and forth with us a million times of just like, what is the appropriate size? But I think the appropriate size is like, people get more chances to be alive, so that's the other thing.
Right. We've talked a lot about how people kind of have like a knee-jerk reaction to the whole harm reduction space. Do you find that you have language that you can use that sort of across the board can make folks understand the importance of your work?
You know, I am a very mushy person, so like I definitely... You have to know your audience, and sometimes it's like, oh, the, like, mushy pieces will focus on them, but, like, overall, like, this saves money, like, so much money. I mean, in America, for substance use-related illnesses, uninsured people, it's, like, $700 million a year for hospitalization. I'm talking, like, wounds, overdoses, everything in between. And again, I'm not factoring in inflation for that. So we're probably hitting like 9 right now. but like just the cost alone of like a 2-cent syringe makes a huge difference for all of us. Mm-hmm. Because if less people have HIV or hep C, less people are having wounds, less people are doing vein damage to themselves, like the more we're healing people, it's better for us as a community and it's better for everybody's paychecks. Because, you know, that's the stuff that's, like, people who you just can't get through, they want to hear. So overall, it saves money. But the important thing is just, like, substance use disorder is a chronic illness. Substance use is just people using drugs. But that chronic illness is, like, I like to relate it to, like, diabetes a lot. Because in my presentations, I have, like, this one chart that talks about, like... It's basically just a set of steps, and at the top it says excess, and at the bottom it says abstinence. And when you move up towards excess, you are increasing your risk. But when you move down towards abstinence, you're decreasing your risk. And any step in between is a huge step forward. So if I have a participant who's living outside and they're telling me, hey, I stopped injecting toilet water this week. That's like a gigantic victory that I think people think is silly, but it is a huge victory because that means that that person is caring about their own health and wellness just a little bit. Like it, you have given them the power to feel like they're worth it just a little bit, which means that over time it'll change. And so like when you compare that to diabetes of like if I don't take care of my sugars, my risk increases. If I do, my risk decreases. So I think that risk piece of like talking about like, we're never going to get good, better, best. There's never going to be a full stop of drug use in the world because the war on drugs is over and drugs won. So now we need to figure out how to mitigate that risk for folks. And I think when you frame it like that, people start to get it. Just like, I'd rather have somebody like smoke cannabis every single day than inject illicit dope because we don't know what's in that. At least they can buy from a dispensary. So like try and working on the just like one step forward. So yeah, it's complicated. But I think that when you really sit down with folks, like I said earlier, it just comes from pain. And teasing out that pain with them is like where you get the good answers.
Yeah. We're, you know, we've talked a little bit about the misinformation, but are there any other kind of big things that stand out to you that you find you're always correcting in terms of, yeah, what kind of misinformation is happening? What incorrect stuff are you getting in your face?
Nobody wants to put fentanyl in your cannabis. They're selling you cannabis. They just don't. Like, people who use drugs are not looking for that sensation. And a lot of times what's happening is like, and I do not blame people who use drugs who do this, but like if you are, you know, law involved and you get a test back that says you took fentanyl and you're telling them I only smoked weed, probably used fentanyl, which is fine. But you should be able to have like safe conversations with those people. That's a whole other issue. But it just like scientifically fentanyl has a way lower combustion rate than cannabis. So like if I'm lighting a bong that has fentanyl sprinkled on it, like my fentanyl's going to burn off before I even go to take a rip. So like it's like safety there. And the other thing is that like you are also not going to passively overdose if a wisp of wind carries a fentanyl like powder towards you. I don't know how to tell people that I would be like so very, very dead if that's what was true.
That's, I've heard that one recently, that people have started getting very panicky about even kind of being in the presence of, and I was like, I don't feel like that's how it works, but maybe I don't know.
It's definitely not how it works because we have skin on our bodies that protects us.
That makes sense. Checks out. Checks out. I do.
Yes. We have skin on our bodies that protects us from outside factors. It's the same reason that like dust doesn't get on my cheek. And then I also have dust in my like skin, like in my muscle tissue. But I think it like, I think people get mixed up with fentanyl because of fentanyl transdermal patches. Because that's a medical device designed to go through your skin over several hours. And it's also medical grade fentanyl. And then they hear, oh my God, fentanyl. If I touch it, it's going to go through my skin. So I think like maybe folks get mixed up there. But really, it kind of comes down to like the misinformation is that it's super dangerous to push this. Because if you are telling people that you cannot get near someone who is overdosed or you think is overdosed or you think has fentanyl around them, then they're going to die because no one's going to respond to their overdose. And at least with law enforcement, because we've all seen the videos of like there's fentanyl in the air. I've Narcanned myself. I think it's just a good reminder of just like misinformation is scary for all of us. It can give us all anxiety and it can put us into these states of fear that are just like not necessary. If you are giving yourself Narcan, you're not overdosing. It's kind of like the rule of thumb. Like,
yeah,
it's not self-administered. It's not an EpiPen. And there are like, I think we also like harm reductionists kind of took like, when Narcan became a nasal formulation and it was so easily accessible for a lot of people, which is not everywhere, like New Hampshire, we're very Narcan saturated. We're very lucky. But like once that became available for like laymen, I think people just went crazy and were just like, well, no amount of Narcan is going to hurt you. But like too much naloxone can hurt people who are opioid tolerant. Like there's something on the market called nalmefene. under like the brand name Opvi or Zyrini. I can never say it right. And that has a half-life of like 11 hours. So if I'm somebody who uses opioids every day, I get nalmefene. I cannot get high for 11 hours. And a lot of people are thinking, awesome, you can go into treatment, right? No. No one is going into treatment after an overdose like that. You are in the worst pain of your entire life. You're in something called precipitated withdrawal. And it's like regular withdrawal, but it has an instant onset. So you are just instantly flush, diarrhea, puking, the worst muscle and body aches of your entire life, restless legs, just like everything you can imagine. And that's for 11 hours, and there's no relief. So some folks will end their lives because of that horrific pain they're in. Like, compound that on top of living outside.
Right.
That's even worse. And it's just not necessary. It's not something that people who use drugs need. Like, we've had, you know, it wasn't broke. We didn't need to fix it. Like, intramuscular naloxone is like a 0.4 dose. That's really, really easy for people who use drugs to administer. And a lot of folks will report like, oh, yeah, I could breathe again. I was still a little high. I didn't have to use. So my risk of overdose is lower. So I didn't have to go use more and then be at risk for overdosing again. Wow. So, you know. Misinformation, while it seems helpful in some cases, can really, really hurt people who use drugs. And they've kind of gotten the brunt of it for forever. So,
yeah, I mean, there's one specific Facebook group essentially that acts under the guise of, you know, being helpful for information for what's going on in Dover. And really, it is just straight up fear mongering and just being nasty. And the things that we see in there are exactly why we were so excited to chat with you, because the misinformation, like you're saying, you know, it comes under the disguise of this is really helpful for you and your family. And really it's not. It's hurting so many people.
Yeah. And, you know, it like what drives me crazy in those like townie groups is like moms. Moms drive me crazy in there. As a mom, as someone with a toddler who would also be terrified if my toddler picked up a syringe on the playground, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But then I would remember, oh, wait, the statistics of infectious disease like HIV or HCV on that needle being carried to my little one lower the longer it's been there. Not to mention, with access to syringe programs, needles go away. Because participants are self-led. Like, if you come to the exchange with 50 needles, I get to give you 60 back. So that means that participants are, like, digging through playgrounds and digging through parks to get rid of needles.
Mm-hmm. That's so interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's all these policies impact each other. That's what I'm thinking about as you're talking, too, is, like, the Medicaid. We've been having conversations about Medicaid and that being cut. And I'm sure you see the ripple effects of that in a big way in your work. And, like, and yeah, I think the mom's piece is really interesting. And I'm curious, like, are there any other things that, like, I'm somebody that doesn't have a lot of knowledge about this topic. I'm learning a lot. This is really helpful. As just like a mom who's going about my life in the community, what are some other things, a mom with a big mouth, what else should I know, right? That's like misinformation. Are there other things that you come up against that you're like, I wish that the people in these effing Facebook groups knew this? Because yeah, I see people panic about needles. I see it's a lot of kind of panic about stuff like that feels misguided, but I don't have the knowledge to say, hey, you know. So what do you wish people knew that they could kind of help spread? Is there anything else that jumps to your mind?
I mean, positively, like, carry naloxone, know how to use it. It's so simple. I keep it in my diaper bag, in my purse. Like, if your toddler gets into it, and mine has, they're fine. They get a gross taste in their mouth if they put it in their mouth, but it has no negative effects unless you have opioids in your system. I think that's a huge one. But like, the biggest thing I can tell, especially moms that maybe even are supportive of recovery, but like don't get the nuances and harm reduction, is like, see a needle, don't post it. Just like, you see a tent, don't post it. I know that's so much easier said than done, but like, leave the tents alone. You don't need to blow up somebody's spot, especially when they're unhoused. It's unnecessary. It's hurting people. And then you get the people that are really super duper hurt and have to just be hateful about it. So I think that just keeping your mouth shut, moving on. If you see a syringe and you're really, really afraid of it, you can talk to the syringe. You can talk to us at NHHRC and we'll figure it out for you. But honestly, put a glove on. Don't touch the sharp part. Put in a sharps container. Dover has a public sharps container. And if not, I'll get you a sharps container. Like, email me. I will get you a sharps container.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like, honestly, even if we're going to take what you just said and, like, put it into a little text box and put it into every, you know, like, ridiculous fear-mongering comment that we see on there that's like, nope, never going to the park again. Nope, never going outside again. Yeah, exactly. You know what I mean? It's like, what do you mean? Like, yeah. This is not, you know, this is existing in a world. You know what I mean? Don't post about it. You're right.
In a community. What if it was somebody who has type 2 diabetes and then just dropped out of their pocket?
Mm-hmm.
Or like maybe they were injecting their cat with insulin. Like, there's a million different reasons why a needle could be there. But also, I think that's like the biggest message I can send people about harm reduction is that, like, it's boring. The supplies are boring. Like, they're not scary. They're just like materials that we use to keep people safe that should be in doctor's offices and community spaces. And it's just like, you guys are getting really excited over nothing, because I promise I've made a million safe injection kits. My toddler has made safe injection kits and they're not scary.
Yeah.
Like, it's nothing.
So I know that you do safe injection kit trainings and then other educational events. Do you have anything coming up that people who are interested can attend or?
Yeah, so I have nothing coming up because I'll be on leave in September. But I do have lots of stuff online right now. We just developed a overdose response train, like prevention and response training with BCTV, Bedford Public Television. And our lovely marketing director made it into a beautiful, like, here's everything you need to know. Talks about fentanyl, misinformation, and how to respond to an overdose, which is really fast to learn. Could probably teach someone in 15 minutes. And so that's on our YouTube page, which I believe is just NHHRC on YouTube. So folks can view that. I also have a training for providers. So if people are looking for CEUs, continuing education credits, and their providers, if they're social workers, docs, nurses, we teamed up with North Country Health Consortium to do an enhancing provider skills training, self-led on Moodle, do it on your own time. But I believe you get 3 hours of CEUs, which is a big deal. So, yeah. If folks are looking for that, I can probably link them to it in, directly. And, cause I don't think we have that one up on our website. And of course, like, we always have volunteer night. So every Thursday, 3 to 6 at Concord 40 Center Street, come make safe injection kits with us. We also make literally every kit in between. So safe for smoking, safe for snorting, foil kits, wound care, band-aids, boofing kits. Everybody loves the boofing kits. So,
you know, most of our listeners are people who want to get involved. They want to take more action. They want to know. I think there's been a lot of really helpful takeaways in this conversation, even just from a sense of being informed and being able to go into those conversations that we're talking about and be like a better advocate for this community. But, you know, we like to give them one quick thing. So, like, what's one quick thing that people can do if they're trying to get more engaged in this work?
I had been thinking about this one long and hard, but I think the biggest thing, other than carrying naloxone, other than beating down misinformation and staying quiet on Facebook when we see needles, I think the biggest thing that folks can do is, like, if you have fiscal means, give to direct service providers. So, like, there are so many nonprofits that are like nonprofit banks, but if it's a program that's actually serving the direct community, I think that's a huge piece. Like New Hampshire Mutual Aid Relief Fund, Repo Fund, us will always do direct service. We'll never have a program that's not like, if I'm not getting syringes into the hands of participants, then it's like, what's the point of it? But I think like giving fiscally to those direct service providers is like a huge thing that we can do. And if you can't give fiscally, come volunteer, come hang out with us. You don't even have to make kits. You can just hang out and listen to like one of us talk nonstop. It's usually me, but yeah, just get in the know with these groups and try to spread the message yourself. It's really easy to just be like, I actually heard and read a scientific article that that's not true. So
yeah.
And then you mentioned people carrying naloxone. Mm-hmm. How do you get your hands on that?
So you can go to any doorway in the state. Doorways are like the hub and spoke model for folks that are looking for recovery. They have naloxone. If they won't give it to you, any SSP will. So any syringe service program has naloxone. Of like, most of them have intranasal, some of them have intramuscular too, and they'll hook you up. There's also places all over, like Teetotaler has extra. I think there's some places like White Heron on the seacoast that has extra. Anybody on NHHRC, email us, Facebook group us, whatever you need, we'll get you Narcan because it's super easy. And you should not be spending $50 at CVS for it. Please don't.
That's a good quick thing, too. Yeah.
Yeah. Don't spend $50 on it.
Thank you so much for coming today. This was so helpful. I like personally learned so much. That was really, like, I can't even imagine how people feel coming out of your sessions.